Thank you for your own historical work in the field, because you have helped to put together some primary, a sense of a starting place. Could you tell me about your own pathway to addiction research?
My work in addiction research began in 1974, when I started working in Dr. Everett May's group as a postdoctoral fellow. I was trained only in organic chemistry in graduate school, and I had worked for Sibagagi Pharmaceutical Company for a few years after I finished my military service. At Walter Reed Army Institute of Research, where I worked on anti-malarial drugs. This was during the Vietnam War, when the falciparum malaria was a very serious problem over there, and it was the cerebral malaria that was drug resistant. And so the Army had a big program on anti-malarial drugs. When I finished there, I worked for, like I said, for Sibagagi a few years, and then I decided that industrial research was not what I wanted to do. So I left a very good job in process research at Sibagagi in Summit, New Jersey, to come down and take a postdoctoral position at NIH. and so I started, I knew how to make compounds. I didn't know why I was making them or anything about pharmacology, but, I was... had good training both in graduate school and with Sibagagi, and so I was well prepared to do organic chemistry. So I started working with Everett May and worked with him for 2 years until his retirement in 1976, I believe it was, in February of 77, somewhere along there. I can get these dates exact.
It's wonderful that you can do that.
And so, as I said, I could make compounds very well, and so they recognized that I could do this, and so I ended up getting a permanent job at NIH, which even then was very difficult to do. But Dr. May helped me a lot, and I began to, there were a number of pharmacologists working in the building that I worked in. Phil Skolnick was one. He was working on the mechanism of action of benzodiazepines. And so he was a good friend of mine, and I learned a lot of pharmacology from Phil. And then, of course, with Arthur Jacobson, he was the biological coordinator of the drug testing program. He succeeded Everett May after Dr. May's retirement. And so Arthur and I were in adjacent rooms, and we talked a lot about pharmacology. One thing that's kind of interesting, when I first started working in chemistry with Everett May, a fellow named Bob Ouellette, who was involved with NIDA, NIDA chemistry program at that time, he and Arthur used to sit there and talk for what seemed to me to be hours about how these drugs worked, or does it do this, or does it do that. And I couldn't understand how they could spend that much time talking about stuff like that until I really began to get a little bit of understanding myself of how these drugs work. Is that enough of how I entered the field?
Yeah. Could you talk about what your working relationship was like with Everett May?
It was wonderful. Everett May is the best example of a Southern gentleman that I've ever met. He was a person that could motivate anybody just by being there and just by example. He was an excellent scientist. He's still living now. He's 90. He'll be 90 on August 14th, and I think it's August 14th. I'm not sure. Okay, He'll be 90. And I talked to him last week, actually, about some stuff. And so Everett May was a wonderful guy, a wonderful scientist, and he influenced my career more than anyone else in terms of motivation towards pharmacology and drug abuse research. He recognized what I could do from an organic chemical synthesis viewpoint, and he thought that would be good for the field, and that's how I ended up getting a permanent job at NIH.
What do you think drew him to the field?
Everett May?
Yes, why was he so motivated?
Well, when this program started in 1929 at the University of Virginia, and it was small, Lyndon Small, and I can talk about him if you want to.
I'd love to hear.
Lyndon Small, Eric Mazzetic was his assistant, who came from a chemical group in Austria, and also Alfred Berger was an assistant that came with Mazzetic. And Everett May joined, that was in 1929, that Everett May joined that group about 1936, 37. So he was a postdoctoral fellow, and that group was small. He's, I think, the only one that's still alive that was in that original group in Charlottesville. They moved from Charlottesville, they spent 10 years in Charlottesville, and then they came to 25th and E Street in temporary quarters. They in Washington for something around 2 years, and in May of 1940, they moved into Building 4 after it was completed. And Everett May then was had left the group after completion of his PhD. Spent a couple of years in industry and basically did the same thing I did. He decided he didn't want to work in industry, so he came back to work with Dr. Mazzetti. And he joined the group on December 1st, 1941. And his PhD thesis was on antimalarial drugs. I have a copy of it, by the way. And then he started working in the drug abuse field. They suspended the opioid research during the Second World War to work on antimalarials. And Dr. May discovered an antimalarial that proved to be a life-saving drug in Vietnam, and I can get to that later.
Which was?
This was, I don't know whether it really has a name, what the drug name for it was. It was a bromophenanthrene methanol class compound. And this proved to be a life-saving drug for that resistant falciparum malaria in Vietnam. So after the war, see, methadone came from Germany. And we didn't know anything about methadone until after the war. The Germans didn't have access to opium very well, but they had methadone, and that's what they used. The main drug they used to treat battle casualties it was an important drug that Germany used to treat pain and battle casualties. And after the war, we became aware of methadone, so it was taken back. And then at the end of the war, they stopped working on antimalarial drugs and started working back on opiate drugs. And methadone was a new structure for them. Mm-hmm. It came from Germany, so it was brought back to NIH, and Everett May started working on making derivatives of methadone. And he made all the possible methadoles, which is reduction of the carbonyl group to an alcohol group. Now you got two asymmetric carbon atoms, so you got you start getting into optical and optical isomers and diastereomers and stuff like that. So he made all the methadoles, and he made all the acetyl methadoles, one of which was LAM. Mm-hmm. And that's where Lamb came from. So that's how Everett May got in. And then as time, I've got a photograph of that group that was taken in the 50s. And we,
oh, I'd love to, yes.
We,
if you could reproduce it?
You mean
have me reproduce it?
Yeah, I can reproduce it. There was one, we knew there was one unidentified lady in that photograph. That the only other person that's alive that was in that group was Joe Ager.
Yes.
And Joe, this is where I got this picture.
From Joe.
From Joe.
Ah.
And you know, you ought to talk to Joe Ager.
I should talk to Joe. I Art mentioned him, and I think I will follow up with him.
Yeah, I have his contact information if you want it.
Mm-hmm.
Joe couldn't remember this lady's name. And Dr. May, this was just a couple of weeks ago, I sent a photograph, a copy, a high-quality Xerox copy down there. He couldn't remember her name either. And so he said, you know, I know her name, I just can't remember. That was over 50 years ago. And I started looking through Dr. May's papers. And Louise Atwell was the main biotest. Have you heard of Louise Atwell?
No.
Oh, boy. This is going to take a lot more time than 1 hour, I can tell you, if you want to go into this. Louise Atwell was Dr. Eddy's biological assistant. Dr. Eddy refined the hot plate test. Louise Atwell was a technician who was there when I started in Dr. May's group. She was a technician that ran all the assays, the hot plate assays. That was the only test they had for a while. It detects morphine-like compounds. Mm-hmm. It doesn't detect certain other classes with mixed profiles as well. But it doesn't detect antagonists. Naloxone went through that test and was deemed to be an inactive compound, and it sat around for a long time, and they started figuring out, hey, this thing might be an antagonist. I went back looking through Dr. May's papers, and there was one, they usually didn't acknowledge Louise Atwell, you know.
Yes.
But there was one paper in there when where they acknowledge Louise Atwell and this lady, Flora, I can't remember her last name. I'll think of it in a minute. And I have it written down. And then I called up Dr. May and I said, I can't remember her last name. Does Flora whatever ring a bell? He said, yeah, that's it.
Yes.
I think that's it.
One of the things I'll do when you get the transcript is ask you for these kinds of names.
Okay.
So you'll have plenty of time to
figure okay. out. I'll probably think of it before the interview, so this part of the interview is over. So that's, you know, how Dr. May got into it. And then he started, you know, I guess I'm about a 5% historian myself.
Mm-hmm.
I've always enjoyed, you know, who did what and keeping up with stuff. But then Dr. May, he worked on methadone with Eric Mazzetti. I have all of Dr. May's papers, too. And have his CV and bibliography. And then, do you want me to continue with Dr. May's career, or?
Well, could we, when do you want to do Lyndon Small?
Anytime you want me to.
It's hard. Let's continue with May and kind of wrap that up.
Okay.
Let's do a chunk, and then let's go to Lyndon Small.
Okay, and how May's work still influences our research program at
yes,
NIH.
Yes, yes.
Okay. So then, in 1953, or thereabouts, Everett May was born in 1914, I think August 6th or something, 1914. I've got the exact date. But I'm sure it's August 1914. So then by 1954, he was, I guess, 40 then, wasn't he?
Mm-hmm.
So he was beginning to become his own scientist, mm-hmm. you know?
Yes.
He had served his his PhD degree under Small and Mazzetti. He had been Small, he had worked with Small, I guess, I mean with Mazzetti and with Small for a period of years, and then it was time for him to become, even before this, with methadone, but it was May started some very significant research that he himself originated in the early 1950s. And this was the first paper that they published, a series of papers, mostly in the Journal of Organic Chemistry, called Structures Related to Morphine. It was a serial list of papers, and they got up into well into the 30s, I think, before that they quit publishing that. But one thing, the whole goal of the program was small, and with the analgesic program was to find a non-addicting morphine. Mm-hmm. And of course, they came up with Metapon. And when I talk about small, I'll get into Metapon. But so then they were looking for other structures. So in that chapter that I wrote, you'll see a diagram that shows how Everett May conceptualized a class of drugs known as the 5-phenylmorphans, and how he conceptualized a class of drugs known as the 6-7 benzomorphans. Okay, the first one he published was the 5-phenylmorphans, and this is a very interesting class of compounds. Do you have any training in chemistry?
Not enough.
Not enough. Okay, let me just say this: molecules, you know, are very small, three-dimensional objects, and like your right hand and your left hand, they can form mirror images in certain cases. Mm-hmm. Okay. Now the phenylmorphans are one case where you can form mirror images that are different compounds. They have different effects on biological systems. They have almost all the chemical properties are the same, but there's one significant difference in chemical properties that I won't go into. But they have different. If you view the drug recognition site as a glove, only the left hand fits the glove, the right hand doesn't.
Do you like the glove metaphor better than sort of lock and key? Why do you use it?
The glove, the lock and key doesn't say anything about mirror images. The glove mm-hmm. does.
Mm-hmm. Good.
The opium products have mirror images too. And with morphine, you can synthesize the unnatural isomer of morphine, which we did, which I can talk about later on. And it turns out that only the naturally derived morphine has any narcotic action. In other words, the mirror image form of morphine that you can make by chemical synthesis doesn't have any effect on the receptors or any biological effects. Mm-hmm. However, when you get to the phenylmorphans, both of the isomers have effects. And it makes them a very interesting class of compounds. They have different effects. One of these isomers of this phenylmorphan that May synthesized, one of the first in that series, was four times as potent as morphine in the animal test. Like, it was just like morphine, only four times as potent. The other isomer was what's known as a mixed agonist-antagonist, like nalorphine. It had morphine. It was equipotent with morphine in the animal test for analgesia, the hot plate assay. But yet, it would antagonize the effects of morphine. So here you have mirror image forms of this compound. One is a morphine and the other is an antagonist of morphine. Now, how does that work? And how does the receptor recognize them differently to elicit these different effects? Now, this whole thing is complicated by multiple opioid receptor subtypes.
Yes.
Okay, a compound can be a mu agonist, it can be a kappa antagonist, it can be a kappa agonist. The point of all this discussion is that Everett May came up with two very important classes of compounds. Now, the benzomorphans, so the phenylmorphans are very interesting for the reasons that I described. And so our work has centered, part of our work has, this is going to get complicated from an organic, from a, to a non-chemist.
Okay. How should we do this?
Phenylmorphans have a ring that they can spin around like this, okay? And it has a hydroxyl group on it that's essential for the activity. So if you have your one part of the phenylmorphan like sitting still, the other group is rotating, it can take any angle it wants when it binds to the receptors. Mm-hmm. Okay? Mm-hmm. So what we've been doing is locking that ring that can spin into fixed angles with respect to the rest of it and looking at activity of those, hoping to be able to determine which angle of this ring confers the full agonist activity and which angle confers the mixed agonist activity. So with this, we may learn more about the combining site for drugs to confer this type of one type of pharmacologic activity or other.
Okay, so that is the phenyl.
Phenylmorphans, okay. Five phenylmorphans.
Okay.
Now the organic chemistry for the chemical synthesis of these compounds is pretty complicated. I mean, it's pretty tough to get these reactions to work right, to get in some cases, and we've been working on this for a while. And there's actually 12 racemates possible in this series that we're working on, and we've synthesized 10 of them now. No, 11 of them. And so we're pretty close to getting the last compound. It required developing new chemistry to get some of these compounds. Now, the 6-7 benzomorphans are simplified opiate drugs. They're, you can take morphine and you can take some of the groups away from morphine and open up one of the two of the rings and you end up with the 6-7 benzomorphans. This is however it may conceive the dissection of the morphine molecule, and they synthesized the 6-7 benzomorphans. This was an attempt to simplify the morphine carbon nitrogen skeleton and get active drugs. It was already known at that time that mepiridine was distantly related to the morphine alkaloids, and it was a much simpler compound than the morphine alkaloids. So that was one impetus for simplification of the structure. A little bit later, in the late 50s, Kenneth Bentley in England started making more complex structures. And this is where from the Diels Alder products of thebaine, this is where etorphine came from. This is this compound that's 7,000 to 9,000 times as potent as morphine, depending on which test you use. And this is where buprenorphine came from out of that series. And nalbuphine is where buprenorphine came from.
And tell me the story of so Kenneth Bentley?
He originated the more complex. See, May was making simpler compounds and getting very interesting compounds. Bentley said, well, let's make them more rigid, mm-hmm. and let's make them more complex. And they used a reaction in organic chemistry, starting with thebaine, known as a Diels-Alder reaction, to build up another ring onto the morphine to the morphine carbon nitrogen skeleton. So he made them more complicated, and they also got interesting compounds that are still, that series is still being worked on today by John Lewis. Have you heard of John Lewis?
Yeah. No. Wait. Where did buprenorphine come from?
Buprenorphine is a compound that was synthesized in that work. With Bentley, when
okay.
Bentley was the boss,
yes.
And John Lewis, who later became director of chemistry at Reckitt and Coleman,
yes.
Was the one that pioneered buprenorphine and to get it, pushed it to get on the market.
Yes.
Okay, but the buprenorphine came out of that chemistry that Bentley and Lewis and others were doing. This was paper that they published 5 papers. Back to back in the Journal of the American Chemical Society in the early 60s, describing all of this, a lot of this work that they had done up to that time. in disclosing the incredibly potent compounds that came out of that series, because at that point, before those papers were published, the most potent compound known to man, known to Dr. Eddy, was etonitazine. Have you heard of that compound?
No.
This is a funny structure. It's 1,400 times as potent as morphine. It's a totally different structure from anything related to any known analgesic at the time. It was discovered at Ciba-Geigy in screening of compounds. Of course, like most compounds, it was synthesized as something else, but it gave that Straub-Tail reaction.
Yes.
That is a very, that's an indicator of morphine-like activity. So the etonitazine was, they did very careful optimization of the structures by making a lot of compounds and testing them, and that's published in Helvetica Chemica Acta, and I think it's 1955, and the first author is Hunger, I think. I can get that reference for you, but that was a very interesting compound. It's got a mu agonist type profile, and there's some evidence, pharmacologic evidence, for mu1 and mu2. Subtypes of mu receptors, and it has more respiratory depression per unit of it has a lot of respiratory depression with it, and that's why it never went anywhere. It offered no advantage over morphine. Just because it's more potent doesn't mean it's any better than morphine. You know, when you get into these ultra potent compounds, just a small error in measurement can kill somebody. That's another minus of these ultra potent compounds. Of course, this has been overcome with fentanyl and sufentanyl and these extremely potent, sufentanyl in particular, and fentanyl, 80 times as potent as morphine. So, let's see, now where were we? We were talking about...
6-7-benzomorphans.
Yeah.
So we have the two classes.
Phenylmorphans, 5-phenylmorphans and the 6-7-benzomorphans. So the 6-7-benzomorphans that Everett May discovered, now he must have published about 80 papers on that. These were very important. The discovery and the correct evaluation. You can make compounds and you can evaluate them, but if you don't evaluate them correctly in the right test, you're not going to find, you know, everything out about the compound. And Eddie's work with Eddie as pharmacologist and with Clifton Himmelsbach, first at the federal penitentiary in Fort Leavenworth, and then in temporary quarters. It started about 1934. And then in 1935, May of 1935, they moved to the new quarters in Lexington. Mm-hmm. And they at that time, they were allowed to study drugs in humans.
Yes.
And first they studied some of these 6-7-benzomorphans that May had, and his associates had made, and found that... they didn't see in monkeys. They didn't seem to produce. Some of them didn't. One or a few of them didn't seem to produce morphine-like dependence. So, but yet they were strong analgesics that would go up to 50 times as potent as morphine. But then later, when they got him into man, they showed some propensity to develop produce dependence. Some of those compounds were, you know, in the benzomorphans, they cross over to kappa agonist more than they tend to do in general in the morphine series. They get more kappa character, and kappa agonists are dysphoric. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So they were testing some of these compounds that were very potent. Cyclazocine is one, very potent compounds in the animal test. But then when they put them into humans, instead of being euphoric like morphine or heroin, they were extremely dysphoric. And they didn't understand why these compounds were dysphoric at the time, because this was well before the discovery of the opioid receptors. All they knew is it made these prisoners felt horrible and wouldn't take the second dose in some cases. Mm-hmm. But that later would turn to be kappa agonist.
And this was Wickler, Isbell, who was doing?
You know, now, that's one thing I don't know so much about. in terms of the actual day-to-day operations and who was running what. I know Wickler was involved in that. And the, Don Jasinski.
Yes, I've interviewed Don.
Well, he knows all about that, and yes. So does Jerry Chaffee. Mm-hmm. Okay. But Himmelsbach was involved in this also. Himmelsbach invented the Himmelsbach scale for measuring morphine withdrawal.
Where?
I think that was at Lexington.
Okay. You think it was there?
Yeah.
I don't think he invented it earlier at Leavenworth.
Maybe he did. Yeah, I believe you're right. Yeah.
And what's this temporary quarters? Where were they?
When they started this program, the group that originated the program said we need chemistry. And they picked Small, and Small picked Mazzetic and Berger. We need pharmacology. They picked Eddie. And we need clinical. And they picked Himmelsbach. And there were some others involved in the clinical also. And I think Reed Hunt Reed Hunt back in that article that I wrote it, you know, that he said, I think when they were planning this, it was, I think, February of 1928, he said, you know, it may be possible by changing the structure of the morphine molecule to eliminate the side effects and still retain the desired effects. That wasn't exactly the phrase. It wasn't verbatim, but that was the meaning of it. And he said, work like this is going to require the close cooperation between the highest level of chemists, pharmacologists, and clinicians.
Mm-hmm. And so Himmelsbach was doing the clinical testing, and he was first doing it at Leavenworth, and then there was a temporary?
No. When they started the clinical program, they didn't have anywhere to go to set it up. So he was in. They set it up in Fort Leavenworth in the federal penitentiary there until they could finish building Lexington.
Yes. Okay, so then you think he moved from Leavenworth to Lexington.
I know he did.
And you think that the scale was invented at Leavenworth?
I believe it was, but I'm not sure.
But it was called Lexington.
No, Fort Leavenworth is one is in Kansas.
Yeah, yeah. But the scale itself.
The Himmelsbach scale.
Yeah.
Named for Himmelsbach. I think you're right. I think it was developed in Lexington. Now, do you have, in Fort Leavenworth, do you have Dr. Eddy's book?
Yes.
Okay. If you go back in that, you'll probably find that. Mm-hmm. And do you have Arthur's and Dr. May's?
I do.
Publication in Drug and Alcohol Dependence, 1989?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. Let's now go back to Lyndon Small and what you remember of Small.
I never knew Dr. Small. Uh-huh. Dr. Small died in 1959 at the age of 60 or 61. Now, Dr. Small's obituary, he was a member of the National Academy. His obituary is printed in the biographical memoirs of the National Academy. I've got a copy of his obituary if you'd like to have it.
I would.
So Dr. Small, what I know about Dr. Small,
just the Metapon story.
Okay. Well, first, I better preface this with some where the field was when Dr. Small started. Morphine alkaloid had been isolated and first published in 1806. People usually cite this 1805 paper of his, but that is not morphine. That's meconic acid. I have read the original. I've had the original papers printed in German script read to me by a guy that read German script. Mm-hmm. Okay, and I have a translation of his 1806 paper, which I don't have that one. I got the one that he published in 1817. It describes the experiments that he did by giving himself morphine. He isolated pure morphine from opium, obtained it pure by crystallization, and recognized it was a base, recognized it was phenolic, and recognized that it had the same properties in animals, including humans, as opium did. And knowing what we know now about the opium constituents, it had to be morphine. They didn't take melting points for characterization in those days. they used beet juice as litmus paper type of stuff. But it was morphine, and he describes how he almost overdosed himself and the two young subjects in that 1817 paper. I'll see what I got, and I can send that to you too. But morphine was discovered then, and organic chemistry couldn't deal with the complex structure of morphine at that time. So nowadays, if you have a crystalline morphine, it might take less than 24 hours to elucidate the structure completely. They worked on it from 1806 until 1925, until the correct structure of morphine was disclosed, was known. It wasn't proven completely, but it was correctly proposed in 1925 by Sir Robert Robinson, the famous English chemist. Based on years of work. In those days, the way you determine the proof of structure, you determine the structure of a natural product, is you broke it, you use chemical reactions to break it up in smaller pieces, identify the smaller pieces, and then try to put them back together and figure out if the structure you propose meets all the known data. Mm-hmm. And then the final proof of structure was chemical synthesis by using known reactions. And that occurred in 1952 by Marshall, Gates, and Schutte, published in the Journal of American Chemical Society. But what I'm getting at is that Small began his work only 4 years after the correct structure was proposed for morphine. And it wasn't widely accepted, it wasn't universally accepted at the time, because there had been a number of very similar structures that you could argue that, no, it's this, not that, you know?
Yes.
Small chose to accept Sir Robert Robinson's structure and base all of his work on that structure. Mm-hmm. So what Small did is he started derivatizing. Small's program had two arms. The first arm was derivatizing morphine, exploring the chemical reactions of morphine. Test all the new compounds. First thing they did is they took the known compounds, morphine, codeine, dihydromorphine, and made pure samples of them. We have all of Small's old samples. Small smoked cigars, and he used cigar boxes to store his samples in. And we have the original samples from Dr. Eddy's collection.
Where do you have them?
It worked in Bethesda.
In your office? Or
no, I have them in a special secure room.
Good. Okay.
And they're stored correctly. So the first thing they did is they got pure samples of everything. They were the standards. The way pharmacology worked in those days, and even today, you have standard drugs and you measure other drugs relative to them. So Small started, they got the pure samples, and then Small started making derivatives of morphine. And Mazzetic, who was Small's lieutenant, who was a very good organic chemist, he came from Professor Spaeth, S-P-A-E-T-H, I think that's how you spell it. He was a very famous medicinal chemist in Graz, Austria, I think, in the 10s, 20s, and 30s. So the other arm of the program was they knew what chemical functional groups were present in the morphine molecule. They knew it had a phenolic hydroxyl. They knew it had a nitrogen. It was basic. They knew it had an alcohol and stuff. And they also knew that morphine had some relationship to a substance known as phenanthrene. This is an aromatic structure with three rings. Because a lot of the studies in attempting to break up the morphine molecule and degrade it into smaller pieces they were always getting these phenanthrenes. The second arm of the program involved taking the functional groups that were present in morphine and adding them to phenanthrene. Okay, so they were the two arms of the program. And of course, the derivatization of a known active compound was much more likely to yield an active compound than, you know, starting with, you know, compounds unrelated to the morphine structure and hanging groups on it. But one of the compounds that came out of Mazzetti's group was about as potent as, almost as potent as codeine in analgesic testing, but had no dependence liability. They couldn't, it was, had no opiate to produce, did not produce opiate dependence. And that compound went into man.
And that was Metapon?
No. This is a compound unrelated to Metapon. It's the other arm of the program. It was the best compound that came out of the other arm of the program. I think it's NIH 259. I'm not sure. I'll verify that when I get the transcript. Or 257, one of those. But they had an unexpected toxic reaction in humans, and they dropped the compound. And I don't know what type of toxic reaction it was. That's what Dr. Eddy says in his book. I suspect it was a cardiovascular effect, but I don't know. Now, with Metapon, so Small made a lot of compounds. He discovered a lot of different reactions of the morphine alkaloids, and he published a lot of papers in the morphine alkaloids. He studied the chlorocodides, the isomers of the C-ring isomers of codeine, and others. And one reaction that he studied was the addition of alkyl lithium reagents to thebaine. Excuse me, not to thebaine, and also to dihydrothebaine. And he got a compound out of that that was converted through several chemical steps to Metapon. And Metapon was the first example, it was the proof of principle of Reed Hunt's hypothesis that structural manipulation of the morphine molecule may be able to separate the undesirable effects from the desirable effects. Metapon was about 4 or 5 times as potent as morphine as an analgesic, but it produced less dependence, onset of dependence and tolerance was slower, and it was a clear-cut effect. They published one of the papers is this paper in JPET, Journal of Pharmacology and Experimental Therapeutics. And that was published in the 30s. So this proof of principle still, as I said in my chapter, still permeates opioid research today. I mean, examples of this are buprenorphine, butorphanol, nalbuphine.
Great.
Reed Hunt further said that, you know, that synthetic drugs that don't produce as much dependence or tolerance as morphine could lower the requirements for morphine, just like the development of the synthetic local anesthetics lowered the requirements for cocaine. Mm-hmm. So that's how Reed Hunt envisioned this. Mm-hmm. So that's the short story on Metapon, I guess.
Okay, that's great. Now we're within 5 minutes or so of needing to end. So you still very much see the work that you're doing today as founded upon that effort.
Upon Small's work and May's work?
Yes.
Yeah, of course.
And I guess maybe we should just end. And I'll figure out, once I've got this transcript, we'll figure out what we need to do to kind of follow up.
Because what about... we haven't got to opiate total synthesis yet.
I know.
I can come back this afternoon.
Do you want to come back after? Yeah.
The opiate total synthesis is an interesting story.
All right. So how should we do this? I have interviews starting at 3. So if you can come before that.
Yeah, we can come at 2, can't we?